I'd like to offer some reflections tonight on the themes of the retreat, on emptiness and conditionality, and on the practices that we've been doing so far. And I'll be speaking in English, so Kirsten and Subhachyo will be able to follow. Yes. So just to start, one of the central insights in the Dharma, in Dharma practice, in meditation practice, is this understanding that often we're caught up in an unskillful or unhelpful relationship with our experience, or an unskillful way of relating to life, to experience as it's unfolding. So we talk about grasping at experience, holding on to experience in a way that's wishing our experience was somehow different. Does it ring any bells, or does it sound? Okay, good. Everyone's on board. and this in the traditional Buddhist psychology, giving rise to suffering. So perhaps still sounding familiar. And often the way that this is talked about, it's expressed in the formula of the Four Noble Truths, which is one of the core teachings in the Dharma. So these four teachings, that there is suffering, that there's difficulty within our experience, that's part of human life. First truth. And the second, that there is a cause to the difficulty, to the suffering, a grasping or a holding on that I mentioned. An unskillful relationship. And the third, that there's an ending to it, a cessation, a fading away of the suffering, which is in the original language actually Nirodha. Dukkha Nirodha is the third noble truth, and also not by coincidence the name of this organization or community for the ending of suffering. And then finally the path of practice, the meditative path of practice of ethics and samadhi and understanding that aids us in this project of letting go of suffering, of relinquishing suffering, letting go of grasping, really. And we could say that this is a kind of a psychological framework for our meditation, a kind of a teaching that's actually pointing directly to the heart of our experience as we practice. So it's not some abstract study that we engage in. It's not something separate from our experience. It's something that's there that we can look at directly when we turn within. And engage with practice. We can explore this through our meditation practice in a variety of ways. So one of them being the practice of allowing that Kirsten was guiding earlier this afternoon. Really welcoming experience, allowing whatever is arising, giving it space. Noticing if we can accommodate experience, mind states, emotions, body sensations, thoughts, letting them be there. And this being a kind of a direct way of exploring this relationship of grasping and non-grasping. So noticing that our intuitive, habitual response to difficult experiences to push away, to wish it was otherwise, and we're kind of engaging in this counterintuitive practice of welcoming, of opening up, turning towards the difficult, giving space. And again, at the same time, being aware of what happens as we do this, what happens to our experience as we begin to allow, accommodate, welcome. So we can notice that the grasping can at times relax, that what's difficult is actually we can meet it, we can hold it, we can come to another relationship, the difficult emotion or the painful body, the difficult body sensations. We can give them space, we can meet them. And through that, if there is enough accommodation or meeting or space or kindness, the suffering also begins to dissolve a little bit, so that it becomes easier to hold, easier to meet. Do people have an experience of this? Has this happened? A bit of nodding. Yes. Yeah. So if we look at in the context of this retreat, talking about emptiness and dependent origination, looking at it technically, we can say the suffering, the difficulty in our experience is dependent on the grasping. It's like the suffering, the difficulty needs the grasping to happen. We need to be in this relationship of pushing away, rejecting, wanting things to be otherwise. That's how the suffering is created, and it needs the grasping to exist in a way. It doesn't have a separate existence apart from the grasping. So the grasping is always there. When there's grasping, then there's suffering within the experience. When the grasping goes, when it dissolves, the suffering also dissipates. So the suffering is intimately linked. It's inextricably linked. It's like they're you could say they're one thing. They're not two separate things. So I remember struggling with this in my own practice. As I was thinking about this talk several years ago at Gaia House, doing a longer meditation retreat there, and engaging in this practice and looking at this dynamic of allowing and practicing, I think with three characteristics at the time. And there'd been some hindrance that had been coming up, some difficulty in my practice that had felt quite kind of dramatic and strong. And it was like, how do I work with this? And it was quite agitating, and it just felt like, it was there quite a lot. It was difficult to kind of engage or get a sense of depth in practice. It was just this kind of, a struggle to be in retreat for some days. And then I remember this moment. For those of you who've been to Gaia, there's a funny little stupa out at the back, and I was doing walking meditation there. And I just had this sense of like, okay, if this is, you know, somehow kind of like having this intuition or this sense like this is also dependent. Let me see if I can fully accommodate this. Let me see if I can really bring in a way of, a meditative way of looking that will allow, you know, let's test this out, basically. And having this experience of really opening to this difficulty, and the experience actually dissolving, it completely kind of folding as I began to welcome it or began to open to it and kind of disidentify with it. The experience dissolving, the suffering dissolving, and the complexity was gone, along with the self story that had been part of it, part of the difficulty. This kind of everything that happens when you have like a strong hindrance. It's like, oh, why can't I? And what's, you know, maybe I should go home. All of that. It just folded. And I remember it was quite dramatic. It was like, because this had been something that seemed so real or felt so real at the time, as these things do, that there was a seeming reality to it. It's like, wow, what happened? And actually, actually there was this like meditative quietness and quite a strong bliss I felt at the time of this like, wow, this thing that felt so real and so kind of like that I'd been, you know, getting caught up in. It was just gone suddenly. And I also remember this kind of feeling of being astonished and somehow having been deceived by the mind, because kind of realizing, oh, this is, you know, looking back on all of my other experiences on retreat and all of my life, kind of sensing all of the difficulty that I experience is actually like this, all of it. Everything that I've experienced up to this, like for the past, however many years it had been by that point, it was like my mind's been taking me for a ride. I've just been engaging in this thing, and it doesn't have this fundamental. It's constantly been dependent on my way of looking, dependent on my grasping, dependent on my way of holding on to it. And I think partly it was dramatic because the hindrance was quite strong. So the change in the experience was quite strong, from this kind of agitation and difficulty and self-story to this kind of moderate quietness and meditative bliss. And it really stayed with me, or it stayed in my mind. But I'm not saying that an experience of insight or an experience of letting go, it doesn't need to be dramatic in that way. We can look at much more subtle things, and we need to actually. And I remember talking then, going to an interview with my teacher Rob and talking with him, and him stressing, you know, once isn't going to do it, once isn't going to be enough. You know, you have to kind of keep revisiting the insight, you have to keep strengthening it and seeing it again and again. And sure enough, it's like after a couple of days, I was caught up in another hindrance thing, and it's like, what happened? I had that thing, and it's like, surely by now, now 10 years later, it gets better, I hope. Yeah, there was something more to this. Maybe it'll come back. So this is an instance of what the Buddha talks about. The Buddha in the classical teachings places a lot of emphasis on this theory, on this idea of conditionality, on understanding conditionality in our practice. So how one thing conditions another. It's one of the, in a way, one of the central wisdom teachings in the early Pali Canon. There's a section that gets very often repeated in the suttas that Suvacho actually referred to a few times yesterday. And the whole verse goes, when this is, that is. From the arising of this comes the arising of that. When this isn't, that isn't. From the cessation of this comes the cessation of that. And again, I've said this before, but I remember reading this originally in the suttas, and this is like the highest Buddhist wisdom, and it's like, it doesn't even seem to say anything about anything. It's like the ultimate generalization. But that's part of its beauty. It's like we can kind of take it to our practice, and it's like it's applicable on many levels, or we can look at it in relationship to many different things. Can be observed with different factors. So one is the grasping and the non-grasping that I talked about, that we can practice with this practice of allowing that we've been doing today over the day. So that's one way. And I thought I'd just look at a few different factors of conditionality and how they factor into emptiness, or how we can explore them through our practice, really. So one being the Brahma Viharas, kindness and compassion, for example. How does that feel in practice? If we and we don't necessarily need to be doing a formal practice, but just as we're sitting here, how does the quality of the heart, how does that affect our experience? We can kind of bring that in. When this is, that is. What does it give rise to? What's the quality of mind, or how does it kind of color the ecosystem of the mind? What does it bring forth? What happens when we introduce some kindness or some compassion to our experience? What does it do to our thoughts? What kind of thoughts begin to come up, or what kind of thoughts perhaps don't begin to come up? As we hold our experience with a bit more compassion or goodwill. And how do we see ourselves? What does it do to our self-perception, our appearance? Subhachu was talking about the appearances yesterday, about how they're fabricated in different ways and not real. This is one way of exploring, and we can see, oh, this appearance of self, how does it appear if I look at myself through the eyes of love, I think you were saying. And how do we see others? When the mind is a little bit imbued with metta, a little bit more imbued with compassion. Or this retreat, as everyone knows, you know, when we're on retreat, the mind goes through all kinds of mind states. We experience all kinds of things. And how does the retreat appear through the quality of mind? How is it colored? How does this instance feel? What's the mind? What's the quality of mind like now? And how am I hearing this, and how am I perceiving the situation myself and other people in the room? What's the quality? And equally, when this isn't, that isn't, to be attentive to the lack of those qualities. So when the kindness isn't present, how do I see myself? How does my practice feel? How do I orient towards practice? How does it feel to be on retreat? Probably that's when the thoughts start coming up. Maybe I should have done something else instead. Just to be attentive to this, aware of this, how our perceptions are constantly colored by the state of mind, by the kindness or compassion, or by the samadhi or the calm, or then by the agitation or irritability or tiredness. So all of this, an exploration of on the one hand conditionality, and also of emptiness, of how things are empty, how the retreat experience doesn't have any, you know, it's not this way or that way in any situation. It's always colored. It's a coming together of different factors and mind state, mind being one of the factors that shapes perception. We're talking about the dance of perception, the name of the retreat. It's shaping up kind of magically in each instance. Another thing that I wanted to talk about, another dimension where we can explore conditionality is actually ethical alignment. So how we're aligned ethically, and what does that give rise to in the being? I feel like I'm taking a risk here. We're slightly stepping out of the usual kind of retreat, content of a Dharma talk. But last year, about 7 or 8 months ago, Kirsten and I were actually in Germany, standing on a field at Ende Gelände, which is a big direct action to shut down one of the biggest carbon emitters in Europe, one of the biggest coal mines in Germany, an open cast lignite coal mine. And there was about a gathering of maybe 5 or 6 thousand activists who came together because people are feeling very frustrated with the pace or the non-pace of climate policy globally and in Europe. So there's a feeling of like something needs to be done. And it was the first direct action that I'd been to, and I remember talking with someone there. I can't remember her name or anything, but she was taking part in this action, and I was asking about her role, or I knew that she was in like quite close to the front of the formation as we were moving towards these, or when we were due to go into the coal mine, and she was in the so-called police engagement rows, which meant that as like hundreds of people are marching towards the coal mine to try and shut it down, there's a rows of riot police wanting to stop the activists from getting there. So I said, I asked her, how do you, it's German riot police, how do you feel about the violence? I can't remember exactly how I said it, but she said something about, this is about the climate and the future of humanity. And she said it in this kind of like, what are you, an idiot? I don't care about that stuff. kind of say sense. And, it's like I could just sense from her that it was like she was hugely aligned with this thing. It was like, there was this clarity about the importance of the thing that she was doing. And that allowed everything else to sort of fall into place in her life, where it was like there was like this like putting aside this sense of, it doesn't matter if I get pushed around a little bit because this is actually crucial for the times that we're living in. It's like it's in the next few decades that something needs to happen. And just getting a sense of like, I remember being quite touched all, throughout the whole thing, or very impressed by. We kind of get together on these, I've been practicing Dharma for a long time and love the whole thing and the qualities that we can develop. And there I felt like I was seeing so many people kind of portraying or embodying, compassion and courage and love in a lot of different ways. So really kind of struck by, the ethical alignment that I was seeing. And also what it was making possible for people, this kind of fearlessness and clarity that was coming out of it, and empowerment from living out from living out what's important, or taking the steps, actually acting out in the world. Sometimes we can get a sense of this is the right thing to do in my life, but perhaps not having quite the courage to take the steps. And then when we do, when one does take the steps, it's like, well, what does that do to the being? It's like it's there's a kind of a restructuring, an inner restructuring that can happen through that. Again, from the arising of this comes the arising of that. So finally, I'd like to say a few words about view and understanding as a part of the conditionality. So on the one hand, I was talking about grasping and non-grasping earlier, how they can be there can be this. It's possible for us to become to find a place of non-grasping or relate to our experience from a place of allowing, and then that can allow the suffering to dissolve. But actually, if you study Buddhist psychology, understanding is at the sort of the root of letting go. So rather than the practice being this project of constantly having to be in a place of again and again letting go, what we're actually more interested in is what's the understanding that can really kind of sink deep? What's the view? What's the seeing that can let that can make us, help us meet our experience in a wiser way. So I thought I'd finish with a sutta reading. It's a short sutta, called the Vajira Sutta. So it's about a nun called Vajira. And it's a sutta I really enjoy. And interestingly, we were also talking yesterday with Kirsten and Suvacho about, I was talking about this sutta and saying, maybe I should take it here. And about how so often in the way that the Buddhist tradition is structured, a lot of the women teachers sort of have been erased over the past 2.5 thousand millennia through the kind of natural patriarchy of the system. They just sort of get filtered out. So here's a sutta, one of the suttas that survives with an embodiment of a wise woman. Vajira, by the way, means thunderbolt. So it's sister thunderbolt or lightning. So it sets the scene. It's at a town called Savatthi. At Savatthi, then early in the morning, Vajira the nun put on her robes and, taking her bowl and robe, went into Savatthi for alms. So she went begging for her food. When she had gone for alms in Savatthi and had returned from her alms round, after her meal she went to the grove of the blind to spend the day. So it's a forest with this name. Having gone deep into the grove of the blind, she sat down at the foot of a tree for the day's abiding to do her meditation practice. Then Mara, the evil one, wanting to arouse fear and terror in her, wanting to make her fall away from meditation, approached her and addressed her in verse. So Mara is this figure, for those of you who don't know, who's kind of like the hindrances embodied, kind of like the devil figure, who comes and tries to irritate the Buddha and kind of get him distracted and generally, comes to practitioners to kind of get them off the path in some way. And so Mara appears to her or recites this verse to her. And he says, "By whom was this living being created? Where is the living being's maker? Where has the living being originated? Where does the living being cease?" So he poses these questions to Vajira. Then the thought occurred to Vajira the nun. Now, who has recited this verse? A human being or a non-human one? Then it occurred to her, this is Mara, the evil one, who has recited this verse, wanting to arouse fear and terror in me, wanting to make me fall away from meditation. Then, having understood that this is Mara, the evil one, she replied to him in verses. And this is her replying, "What? Do you assume a living being, Mara? Do you take a position? This is purely a pile of fabrications. Here no living being can be pinned down. Just as when an assemblage of parts, there's the word chariot. Even so, when the aggregates are present, there's the convention of living being." For those of you who are not familiar with Buddhist jargon, I'll open it up in a little bit. "There's the convention of living being. For only stress is what comes to be, stress what remains and falls away. Nothing but stress comes to be, nothing ceases but stress," stress being suffering here. Then Mara, the evil one, sad and dejected at realizing Vajira the nun knows me, vanished right there. So if we just take this apart a little bit, so Mara, we can say, appears to her and poses some of these questions, some of this, what in some of the commentaries to this sutta is, or the translator refers to as speculative thought, So it's, we can kind of recognize this from our own practice, that Mara will appear, you know, we'll have these visitations of however they look, you know, we'll be disturbed in our practice. And all of the questions are around somehow herself, are around, you know, who has made her? Where is the person who made her? What is her origination? Where is she headed to? So again, we can sort of translate this into our own meditation experience, thinking, you know, what am I going to do after retreat? how did I come here? What's my life about? All of the questions about me, basically. You know, any questions about me, we can replace here. And then she recognizes him. She recognizes, oh, this is actually Mara. This is just Mara trying to disturb my practice. And then she replies, do you assume a living being, Mara? Do you take a position? This is purely a pile of fabrications. So she's saying, you know, on the first evening, Kirsten mentioned the khandhas, these aggregates, these parts of our experience, you know, the body, body, vedana, perception, sankharas, and consciousness, these different elements of in our experience. And she's referring to them. She's saying, that's actually all that there is here. There's just this body, there's these bodily feelings, there's thoughts coming up, emotions coming up, and moments of consciousness. But there is no self here. So she's in a way speaking from another place. She's not speaking from a place of conceiving of her experience in terms of self. Again, you could say that she's assuming an emptiness perspective. And again, for some of you, this might be familiar and it might make sense. And for other people, it's like, oh, what does this mean? You know, what does it mean? Here, no living being can be pinned down. So she's done her meditative work. She's explored and she's seen. It's all just changing elements, we could say, changing experiences without any fundamental core self. And kind of reach that place of liberation. And then she actually comes up with this. This is for those of you who are kind of Buddhist nerds like myself. this next part is especially interesting because she says, just as when with an assemblage of parts, there's the word chariot, even so when aggregates are present, there's the convention of living beings. So she's comparing the human being to a chariot, to a cart in a way. And she's saying it just as in the same way as we put together these parts, we give it the name, we give it the conventional name. This is a chariot, but it's actually just a pile of parts. She's having the same kind of meditative analysis of the human being, saying actually this is just a pile of experience. Khandhas actually mean piles, heaps. So there's just this heap of the body and the vedana and the thoughts coming up. But they're all, none of them is self. They're just kind of thrown together and they give the appearance, the conventional appearance of a self. But it doesn't have any foundational reality behind it. And this is historically interesting because like, well, maybe 800 years later, Chandrakirti comes about, or 900 years later after the Buddha, and he comes up with this analytical practice, which is known as Chandrakirti's chariot. So this is again, a meditative method, a meditative tool, an analytical meditation, which you can engage in, and you can kind of go through the different areas of experience, looking at them and seeing, searching for the self. And then through an analysis, kind of a meditative analysis, it's revealed, oh, there isn't a self. A self isn't real in the way that I thought it was. So it's a slightly different method. Anyway, it's historically interesting and it's meditatively interesting. That's a way of saying it's not that interesting at all. And then she says, it's only suffering that comes to be. Suffering which remains and falls away. Nothing but suffering comes to be. nothing ceases but suffering. So she's got, again, it sounds like super bleak if you take it at face value, but it's kind of, she's moving into this framework of exploring her experience through this, through the Four Noble Truths. So seeing actually anything that comes up, it's just a formation, a fabrication of grasping and letting go of grasping. There's no self involved. It's just perspective. It's just a mode of grasping and non-grasping and the dissolution of suffering. So she's kind of embodying an awakened perspective and meeting archetypally in a way, meeting her demons in a way and saying, look, you know, then Mara, the evil one, sad and dejected at realizing Vajira, the nun, knows me, vanished right there. So just kind of wanting to present this voice or present, for me, it's quite a powerful image, this meeting of someone who's really gone deep in their practice. And then this, you know, this unshakable, in a way, understanding or view of her own experience, seeing, oh, there is no self, or she's able to step into that view. Maybe just to kind of wrap up a little bit. You could say that Vajira in here in this sutta is kind of she's stepping into a meditative way of looking that allows for a kind of a liberation or allows for a kind of letting go, that she can see through the selfhood and kind of step into this meditative gaze or has this meditative practice of disidentification, of seeing non-selfhood. But I think it feels important to say that anyway, this is my interpretation, that's not the sort of final end point of practice. It's like we can think of these meditative perspectives, it's a way of looking that enables a lot of letting go. It enables a kind of a non-grasping, a letting go of suffering, a dissolution of suffering, as she describes. But it's not like, I don't think that's the sort of final end point of practice, or it's not like we're trying to get to a place of erasing ourselves or kind of living constantly from a place of non-self. It's more like we're trying to gain understanding or gain a meditative perspective so that we can step into it when it feels useful. And the same with the, you know, I was earlier talking about the kind of the dynamic, the experience of non-grasping that we can notice, we can welcome experience, we can accommodate it, and then it perhaps at times dissolves. There's a dissolution, and the suffering disappears. But again, the path or the goal of the practice isn't forever to stay in that place. We're not that interested. I don't want to be normative about it. Maybe someone is very interested, but I don't think it's such a wise goal to try and be in a place where we're trying to live constantly with as much letting go as possible. It's just not, it doesn't feel functional in the 21st century, and it doesn't feel like a wise goal. So it's more like we're exploring these ways of looking, or exploring conditionality, exploring emptiness as a way of gaining insights. Gaining understanding. Okay. Thank you for your attention. It's been a real pleasure feeling your depth and sharing the practice. It's now 8:12, and what time is the next session? Do we have this? 9. Okay, so why don't we sit for a while? Just a few minutes so I can...